We are doing Binyan HaBayit, the Jewish home, and we gave out sheets. Everyone should have the sheets. And we'll quickly review what we did last week. We discussed that speech is, conversation is the most underestimated tool. Obviously, this is a class primarily for men, so I mean it is underestimated by men. And we discussed that men's speech is goal-oriented. And women, the speech itself is the goal very often, because the speech itself has the purpose that we are connecting. And we had this whole long story about a wife's very, very long story, and how the husband has to understand that the point of the story is that we're talking. We also brought up the concept that after an argument, men think that if we're going to talk, then let's figure out why we disagree and let's resolve the issue. And women are not willing to do that right away, because first let's talk, meaning let's not talk about what we disagree, let's just talk, because we have to get close again, and then maybe we'll be able to deal with what the problem was. And we brought a story to illustrate that. We discussed that men measure success by individualism, machoism, survival of the fittest, and as such, if we talk, it's just because we need to get something done. But in essence, there's no reason I should tell you what's going on in my life, because I am macho. I don't need you to tell me what to do. And women, they measure success by how much a person is liked by society, how connected a person is to society, how many people share with them what's happening in their lives. Women have this whole set of rules. Like if a woman's expecting, so she has to think through, who do I have to tell that I'm expecting? Men, it's a totally different story. If a guy comes home and tells his wife, my chavrusa, his wife just had a baby, the wife says, and how long has she been expecting? So the husband says, 9 months. And the wife says, and when did he tell you? And the husband says, today. And the wife's like, aren't you friends? And the husband says, yeah, we're friends. What's the problem? So you don't think he had to tell you beforehand? No. Why does he have to tell me beforehand? By women, it doesn't work that way. If we're connected, if we're friends, so then I have to tell you what's going on in my life. If I'm dating someone, I have to share with you that I'm dating someone. If I'm expecting, I have to tell you. If I don't tell you, then we're obviously not connected. You guys familiar with this concept? So this concept is an illustration of how different our speech is. Meaning, by men, why should I tell you? Why should you tell me that you're expecting? What's in my business? By women, what do you mean? If we're friends, then we share what's going on in our lives. So now, within a marriage, there's a problem. Meaning, if the wife's expecting and she doesn't tell her husband, he might be upset. We can understand that, right? Guys, it's a joke. But when we were expecting our first child, so my wife told one of her little siblings, and she said, it's a secret. So that sibling asked, does Netanel know? that's what I was thinking of. Okay. So our concept of speech is different. A guy can come home and neglect to tell his wife he got a raise. Neglect to tell his wife that the boss said that he might be fired in a week. And then he's on the phone with his friend and he mentions it, and the wife's like, what? Why you don't think you have to tell me? And the husband's like, why should I worry you with it? What do you mean, why should you worry? So women expect that men will have this relationship with them as well. Meaning being that by women, part of having a relationship is that you share with me what's going on in your life. So then if you're my husband and you love me, so then you're going to share with me what's going on in your life. Men expect a male relationship with women. I don't tell you anything unless it's relevant. And if it's not relevant, then why should I tell you? And why do you expect me to tell you? So men have to understand women. And the truth is that when men conform to women's needs in speech, men discover a totally new level of their emotional being. Meaning we stunt a certain need that we have, a need to share with people what's going on in our lives. And In the name of machoism, autonomy, however you want to call it, men live this autonomous life, where no one can know that I'm upset. No one could know that I flunked the test. No one could know that I'm taking a driving test today because maybe I'll fail. So I don't want anyone to know I didn't succeed. And no one could know that maybe I got bumped out of the army or 100 other things, because we always have to be success. We're men, right? And in truth, we have a need to share and connect. And when men start adapting to what their wives need, they have a much fuller life because we have that need. Now, I'm not saying that men should become women. We're not. We're never going to talk like women, and we shouldn't. But on a certain level, we do have to conform to that. Did we discuss the halacha of Neshei Amit Garashun? We didn't get to discuss that. Okay. So the pasuk says, the Navi tells the Jewish people, Neshei Amit Garashun mibet ta'anugeha. You chase out my women from their house of pleasure. Chazal say, what's that a reference to? That's a reference to a situation where a couple is prohibited. We know that there's a part of the month where a couple can be together. And then from the time the woman has her period for another 2 weeks until she goes to mikvah, the couple are prohibited from touching, from sleeping on the same bed, from passing things from hand to hand, from eating from the same plate. You know, there are halachas of family purity. So during that period, the beds are separate. But the couple are still going to sleep at the same time, him on her bed, him on his bed, her on her bed. And there is conversation that happens before they fall asleep. The Gemara says, if someone comes and says, you know, my bed in the dorm is so uncomfortable, can I sleep in your house tonight? So he has an option. It's not that he's going to sleep in the street. It's just not a very comfortable option. And then he comes to a couple where the only place they could put him up is in their bedroom. They don't have anything else. You know, once upon a time, people lived, their bedroom was their dining room, was their lunch room, was their, they had one room, studio apartments. So if a person comes to their house and he asks to sleep, a bungalow colony, right? In a bungalow, sometimes that's all you have. You have a studio, you have one room. So if a guy comes and says, can I sleep by you guys? And he could find another option. So what's happening? He's sleeping in the room. The couple couldn't have been intimate that night anyways, because they're prohibited. But, says the halacha, they could have spoken. And that speech they won't be able to have. They'll speak, but it's not the same type of conversation because there's someone else in the room. So the halacha says that person is what the prophet is talking about. Neshei amit garashun, you're chasing out the women of my nation, mibet anugah, from the house of pleasure. A wife waits for that time that she has her husband to herself, that they could talk at night. They say that the Chafetz Chaim used to talk to his wife for hours at night. In the bedroom, when they were both going to sleep, they'd have conversations for hours. So that's what his wife obviously needed. So he steered the conversation in the direction of Ashkafa. He spoke to her about spiritual things, because obviously all she needed was to connect with him. It wasn't of utmost importance for her if they're going to talk about the price of cheese or the or Ashkafa. So he spoke to her about Ashkafa. But he spoke to her for hours, they say. That's what I think his children write. Every woman according to what she needs, but that's part of what a husband owes her. And Allah says you're not allowed to interfere with that time. If you have another option, you don't ask to sleep in their house. So that teaches us, again, this concept that there's time that we owe to one another. And then in the bottom of the page, we went on to the concept, men don't like to explain. Think about it. Your mother asks you, why aren't you taking lunch today? First thing is you flare up. What difference does it make? What do you mean, what difference does it make? Aren't you going to be hungry today? No. Why don't we want to explain? Because I know what I'm doing. I'm not a baby. Well, the same thing happens in marriage. The wife says, why aren't you taking an umbrella? Because. What do you mean, because? It's going to rain today. Why don't you take an umbrella? So from her perspective, she wants to help. From his perspective, what are you interfering in my life, my baby? So a husband goes off, and his wife asks, when are you going to be home tonight? And he says, I don't know. And she says, what do you mean? When are you coming home? So he says, I don't know. I have a lot of things to finish at work. I don't know when I'm going to finish. I don't know when I'm going to get back. So firstly, you have to know that's torture. Chazal tell us that on the pasuk Vel Ishech Teshukatech, that when God told the woman, your desire will be for your husband, what God did was implemented in a woman's nature that the minute he leaves the house, she misses him. So if you have an end period, it's like you're sitting down for a root canal. If the dentist tells you this is going to take 5 minutes, so you could look at the clock tick by and you know in 5 minutes it's going to be over. 6 minutes, you can handle it. There's an end period. But if the dentist says, oh boy, I had this last week, the dentist started doing a root canal, and he said, boy, is this complicated. He tells the nurse, I never did this before in this office. So I asked myself, should I go by I never did this before or in this office? It sounded like he had done it in a different office. So I'm lying there. What choice do I have? Okay. I had a choice, but okay. At the end of the day, I'm still here. With the tube is still intact. He said it was okay. A guy from Machon Meir came for his gear, Bris Mila, and the Mohel looked and said, oh boy. So the guy's being, he's not fully out, and the Mohel says to the staff, this is very complicated, and he turns to the guy and he says, I hope this is going to work. It's a true story. Now that's cruel. I flipped out when I heard that. I don't know if the Mohel is joking or not. I really don't know. I wasn't there. But that's cruelty. It's insane. You think about it. This guy is still Shomer Torah Mitzvahs today, but you know what? That could really turn a guy off. That's just cruelty. So when a guy leaves the house in the morning and his wife asks him, when are you coming back? And he says, I don't know. That's cruelty. What are you doing? You're telling her, I don't know when it's going to end. I don't know. You'll miss me? I'll miss you too. Right. No. Hashem created a woman in a way that she wants you back the second you leave the house. So tell her, I hope to be home by 8. If I won't be able to make it by 8, I'll call you at 7 o'clock and I'll tell you if it's not going to work. But to the guy, why do I have to tell you? I have to limit myself? We always want our freedom. And then a guy once, he goes to the store and he buys a new CD player. Comes home and the wife says, you did what? We haven't yet paid our bills. You bought a CD player? So he says, well, you want me to ask you? So she says, well, why don't we discuss it? And he says, you have to approve everything I do? And she says, but I would never buy a CD player without asking you. I ask you before I do things. So, let's analyze this. What's she saying? I wouldn't make a decision to spend this much money without consulting with you. He's saying, oh, but I would. That's what I want. I'm not going to ask you before I spend the money. So think about it. What's happening here? Because this is a classical point of friction between husbands and wives. What do you say, David?
But she wants to talk about everything, whether it's sensical or not. So to say, oh, we should have talked about buying the CD player.
Yeah, but
you might just as well talk about the dump.
Yeah, but money's different. She's saying before you spend money, before you make this decision, shouldn't we have spoken about it? And he says no. Now, let's ask two questions. A, if she went out and spent 300 shekel on a CD player, what would you feel? So that's question number one, which you have to ask yourselves. And question number two is, let's say he says, I wouldn't care if you'd spend that kind of money without talking to me about it. Why do you even bother talking to me about it? So then, what's the answer to that? I'm going to assume that if he's bothered by the fact that she wants him to talk to her about it, then he also wouldn't expect her to talk to him about it, which we all know is not true. Now, this goes into another realm which we cannot really cover in this class because that's a realm that's very individual, and that is the question of how do you deal with finances. Meaning, this is a question that every couple has to deal with, and people sometimes have misconceptions. Once we've touched upon it, I just want to say a few don'ts. What the do's are, that needs to be worked out. But I've heard of couples that have separate bank accounts. So her income goes to her account, his income goes to his account. Now, what happens when she has to be on pregnancy watch? in the middle of her pregnancy, they say you have to stay in bed now for 5 months. So what's going to happen then? I'm sure he won't let her starve. He'll give her from the bread he buys. Very nice of him. But is that really the way home is supposed to work? And now when he wants to buy things, who's going to save money for the future? I don't see how that works. I mean, I know that Rav Tendler, when dealing with a very modern crowd, told them, ladies and gentlemen, there's no such thing as separate bank accounts. You guys are getting married, you're putting all your money together, and you're making it work. You figure out what your rules are, how much each one can spend without talking to the other one, whatever you guys agree upon, but there have to be mutual bank accounts. There cannot be some hidden bank account. I keep my savings here, she keeps her savings there, we keep the mutual bank account, but we also keep our separate. You're getting married, so you jump in with both feet. So again, I think it's very difficult to say what the do's are, because there are going to be differences within couples. I can only say what the don'ts are. You cannot have separate bank accounts. You can't. It's just that's a dysfunctional family. That means you're walking into marriage with this safety net. So a wife calls me up and says, yeah, but my husband isn't working. He's not willing to make a dime. And I have $50,000 in savings. If I'm going to give him access to that, I know what he does all day. He's sitting on the computer. He's going to gamble it away. It's all going to disappear. So that's you have a problem there. You have to figure out what the solution is going to be. There's a problem. If the guy is a gambler, you have a problem. That's true. Extenuating circumstances might demand extenuating results, but you have to realize that's an abnormal circumstance. The normal circumstance is we have two responsible adults, and in that situation, then two responsible adults are supposed to have a mutual bank account. You can't walk into marriage, but I trust you, but only that far. Like, that's not going to work. You could live two separate lives. For most people, they have no satisfaction of marriage that way. Marriage is we're living together in every sense of the word. So that's a don't. Now, what is the do? How do we manage things? That's already complex, and that depends on a little bit on where you both come from. Meaning, people from certain parts of the world have certain norms. People from other parts of the world have other norms. And it's a little difficult to say this is right and this is wrong. It's not that I don't have an opinion on what's right or wrong, but I'm not sure that the halacha would necessarily say that every couple has to conform to A or B or C. If this works for this couple and that works for that couple, there's obviously a lot of gray area there. But this is something which especially people who grew up in a non-religious or a non-Jewish home should consult with a Rebbe who understands them and can help them work it out, because I've seen too many guys walk into dating and then marriage with misconceptions, and then it blows up in their face. So each person should consult with someone, but to say a general rule up here, I don't feel qualified to do that. I don't know if there is a general rule. Yes?
Is it such a bad idea to say that boys like gadgets and electronics and stuff, and girls like clothes and makeup and filling your up?
No problem. Boys like this and girls like that, but no, there's only a certain amount of money.
If the husband and the wife each spend approximately the same amount of disposable income, and that two amounts does not amount to the full disposable income, they're single.
Okay, so let's go off on another tangent.
You have $100 in disposable income per month.
Let's talk real numbers. Let's say your income is
$100 disposable income per month, and the man spends $40 disposable income per month. The woman spends $40 disposable income per month. They still have $20 just in case somebody says, "I'm coming over for showers unexpected," or blah blah blah, whatever they need.
Okay.
Or the car needs a new carburetor or whatever.
Life usually doesn't work that way. Usually there's suddenly an unexpected dentist bill that costs a lot of money, and there's an unexpected flight you have to go visit a parent who's ill or something else. Life is filled with unexpected serious expenses. Carburetor goes, that's a few thousand checkup. But I would like to, again, if we've gone on this tangent, to just mention a point. There is, and this goes back to what we discussed in the last class, in our Avat Chesed class, there's a very unhealthy, problematic tendency among people of our day and age, and that is to live out to your last penny. And if you have $20 of savings at the end of the month, then you're good. So first of all, unfortunately, in today's society, if you're $20 in the black and not $20 in the red, you're good. But that's wrong. That's wrong. A person is supposed to save money. Part of your income should go to investments, to savings. All too often, couples live in, and especially in the beginning of their married life, they spend everything they got. Guys are bachelors. So I know a guy who's making about $100,000 a year, and he's spending about $75,000 a year, flies all over Europe. He makes a very good living as a lawyer. He's a bachelor. Unfortunately, he's about 34, 35 now. So figure he's been a lawyer for 10, 11 years. The guy's been making over $100,000 a year. So even if he has to have that apartment in Manhattan, fine. He could still be putting aside $25,000, $30,000 a year in savings. If he would have done that the last 10 years, he could easily buy an apartment when he gets married. No mortgage. Okay, so a little bit of a mortgage. And that's not living frugally. But we live in a society where the attitude is, like you just said, if I'm putting aside $20 a month, I'm good. No, you're not. Okay, so I'm saying let's talk real numbers. Let's say you're making 12,000 shekel a month between you and your wife. And let's say you're paying rent 3,000 shekel a month. And let's say your food bills and everything else cost you another 3,000 shekel a month. So you're pretty good. We said, how much are you making? 15,000 shekel a month? 12,000 shekel a month. All your expenses together are 7,000 shekel. You have 5,000 shekel. What does the average couple do? They say, we could afford to go to a hotel for a vacation for a weekend. We could afford to have a car. We don't need it, but we could afford it. And that's a mistake. What you could afford to do is open a savings account, invest that money, and have money to marry off your kids. Have money later on when the expenses go up and up and up. The time to save, to put money aside, is when you're a bachelor and when you're newly married. Not to wake up when you already have five kids, your kids are already 15, 12, 10, and 5, and you're asking yourself, how am I going to put them through college, high school, marriage? And then you want to start saving, and then your expenses are already at peak. Your expenses are the lowest they're going to be when you're a bachelor, and they're second to lowest they're going to be when you're newly married. But most couples, they're newly married, they figure, now it's no problem making ends meet. So let's live it up. What's wrong? We're not living it up. So we'll buy this for Shabbos and that during the week, and we'll go out twice a week. And then they spend that money and they don't feel it because they can afford it, but they don't realize that their income is not going to go up proportionate to their expenses on this level of living. It's not. Your children, Bezalel Hashem, you'll have children. The expenses go up exponentially, and most people's income does not. So then you have to lower your level of living, and then it's much harder to put money aside. So if we've mentioned the point, there's a point you guys have to think about now. You can put money aside, start savings accounts. Don't live up your income. It's not right to say, well, if I have an extra 5,000 shekel a month, so oh great, I can afford A, B, or C. You can't. Do you own a house? You don't need to own a house. There are basic things you have to own. Do you have money set aside to marry off your kids? Later on, the expenses only go up. But again, this is a tangent. But once we brought it up, I wanted to mention it. Okay, so now we're starting where I wanted to start today, with the story of Rabbi Lezer Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Lezer Rabbi Shimon was a big, big, big Talmud Chacham. And this story appears in different sources. But the general gist of the story is as follows. There are different versions, depending on if you see it in Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, or in Tana de Be'elio, or in other places where it shows up. Rabbi Lezer Rabbi Shimon had just finished a very massive learning session, and he was headed back home, and he came out of yeshiva feeling very good. He had just learned very, very well. It was a big, big, big Tana. It was a big sage. And he was riding on a horse on the beach. So now he has the cool ocean breeze, the beautiful view of the beach, and he just finished learning a massive amount, and he's headed to town where everyone's waiting for him to give speeches and teach. And as he's riding on the beach, a man comes up to him and greets him, not exceptionally respectfully, but not exceptionally disrespectfully. And Rabbi Eliezer looks down at the person and notices that the person has an unusual deformity and he looks horrid. Rabbi Eliezer could barely stand looking at him. And Rabbi Eliezer then says an unthinkable sentence. He says, "How disgusting you look. Do all the people from your town look like you?" At which point, the person turns to Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Shimon, and says, "Go to the one that fashioned me and tell him, what a disgusting creature did you create?" Meaning the guy was telling him, what did I do this? This is how Hashem created me. So Rabbi Eliezer gets off the horse, goes down to the person's feet and says, "I beg you, you're right. I spoke improperly to you. Please forgive me." And the man says, "I'll forgive you after you go to the one who fashioned me and tell him what a disgusting creature you created." So Rabbi Eliezer says, "Please forgive me. I was wrong. I spoke improperly to you." And the man says, "I'll forgive you after you go to the one who fashioned me and tell him what a disgusting creature you created." Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Shimon sees he can't win the person over. So he continues going, and the guy is following him, and they reach the city, and all the people have heard Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Shimon is coming, so the people pack out of the city to greet him. And they greet him, "Rebbe, Rebbe." And the man behind Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Shimon says, "Who are you calling Rebbe?" So they tell him, "That man." So the guy says, "He's a rabbi? This is the person you call rabbi? I wish there shouldn't be many like him among the Jewish people." So the people say, "That's how you talk about the rabbi?" So the guy tells him, "Yeah, you know what he told me?" And he tells him the whole story. And the people tell the person, "Look, he begged you for forgiveness. He said he was wrong. Please forgive him." So the people beg this man, and finally he agrees to forgive him. Chazal tell us this man was Eliyahu HaNavi. Eliyahu saw that Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Shimon had come out of yeshiva feeling very, very good about his learning. And he was riding on the horse on the beach, enjoying life, enjoying in a spiritual way. He had just attained great spiritual heights. And Eliyahu felt he has to bring him down. So Eliyahu came with a tremendous deformity that really shocked Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Shimon. And when he saw him, he was so shocked, he blurted out something he shouldn't have said. And then the guy taught Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Shimon the lesson of his life. Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Shimon was then called in to give a speech. So Rabbi Eliezer began his speech and he said, "Le'olam yehe adam rach kakane ve'al yehi kashe ka'erez." A person always has to be soft like a reed. Don't be hard like a cedar tree. A cedar tree is very tall, very proud. It's the tallest of trees. But bottom line, when strong winds blow, they knock it down on its face. The little reed can be there and all the winds can knock it back and forth and the waters can knock it back and forth. At the end of the day, the reed is still in its place. A person has to be soft. A person has to be flexible. And the reed merits that when we write a Sefer Torah, so the ancient custom was that you wrote with the reed. The Ashkenazi custom evolved that we write with a feather. The Sephardi custom remains that they write with a reed. But the Ashkenazi custom changed. So Rav Lezer said, you see, that the humble reed, he merits that you take him and you use him to write his Sefer Torah. Sometimes we look at people and we feel like we have a right to comment on things that are beyond their control. A husband looks at his wife and says, "You know, you were much better looking when we got married 10 years ago." What do you want from her life? So every husband will give you a list of what he wants from her life. But let's take a more accurate example, because you guys think this is far-fetched. A husband's talking to his wife, and suddenly he turns. So she says, "What's wrong?" And he says, "Well, you have bad breath. What'd you do wrong?" A husband talks to his wife and he tells her, "You know, you really don't have self-confidence. You never stand up to your parents." Now let's stop and think for a second. What are you telling her? You're quantifying a fact. This is the way she is. By quantifying that fact, what have you done? Have you helped her anything? All you've done is spoken. Like Rabbi Elazar of Rabbi Shimon spoke. Yeah, he said the truth. The man was ugly. But what was he saying? He was letting his mouth run without his head thinking first. Let's skip down to the nothing personal. The second to last point. People sometimes think if they say nothing personal, then they could say whatever they want. So let's read the sentences here. I've been thinking about it, really, in all honesty, nothing personal. I realize that you're the most annoying person I know. Now think about that sentence. You guys are all laughing, but think about it. How close to that do we come when we tell people nothing personal? Usually the introduction, nothing personal, is I'm about to get very personal, I'm about to hurt your feelings, but I will introduce it with saying nothing personal. Just like with all due respect. You guys know, with all due respect is an introduction to without due respect. So nothing personal is the same thing. Nothing personal, I just need some time away from you. What do you mean nothing personal? That's as personal as it gets. Nothing personal. I think you're being too touchy. I'm being too touchy? You're hurting my feelings. But I said it wasn't personal. Why do you have to take it personally? Nothing personal. So, firstly, we have to know that everything's personal. It's not such thing as nothing personal. We sometimes think, if I talk to her about things that are just, that's the way they are, so then there's no reason she should get upset at me. I tell her, you know, you don't bargain well. Whenever we go to stores, you give away what our bottom line price is, and we always lose money because you talk too much. It's not personal. I'm just telling you, when we go to stores, be quiet, let me do the bargaining. So husbands will say, well, I didn't say anything personal. Why does she have to take it personally? But let's reverse the tables. Imagine she told you the exact same thing you told her. Imagine she said to you, nothing personal, honey. When we go to stores, you always ruin the bargaining. Just be quiet. How would we feel? First, the first rule is, let's think. If I got the exact same line, usually our thought stops there and we say, yeah, but it's not true about me. You realize how that's not the answer? That has nothing to do with it. The question is, if it would be true, how would I feel if someone spoke to me that way? I want to take an example from a class we had a week or two ago. I got an email about the story I said about women, women talking. And a woman said, I listened to that story and I buried my head in shame. And then I thought to myself, that's so not nice of you to say that story. So I thought to myself, wait a second, why is it not nice? It's the truth. She herself says it's the truth. She buried her head in shame. But then I thought, wait a second. But whether it's the truth or not, it has nothing to do with it. That's not the point. Us men, very often, especially when we're talking about someone else's feelings, our first thought is, wait a second, if what I said is right, what are you upset at me for? It's just the facts. But that has nothing to do with it. It's like Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Shimon telling the person on the beach, you are the most disgusting person I ever saw in the world. He's right. That's what Elio was coming to do. Elio purposely took on the most disgusting features possible in order to shock Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Shimon into reality. But what does that have to do with the fact that you said something insulting? So, on that note, I would like to apologize to all our female listeners. I have to reconsider whether to tell that story in light of that email. But I think that's a perfect example of this point. We all heard it. We all laughed. Even the women who heard it had to admit it was true. And there's an important point there. But at the same time, whether it's true or not has nothing to do with whether it's going to insult someone or not. So that's the beginning. Bezrat Hashem, we will pick up. We will continue on this topic either next week or the following week. Next week, it won't be on Sunday, but we might.